This is Molly Lannon-Kenny, and this is Transparent Yoga and Everyday Life, a podcast.
Coming up on Transparent.
What he would say is that that's all Maharaji bringing you to him, throwing the cassette down on the floor and going, this guy has no idea what he's talking about. The next thing I knew after that, I was swimming in Ram Dass's swimming pool.
My name is Jocelyn, and I am a student of Molly's at the Samaria Center. Today I sat down with her to talk about her recent experience visiting Ram Dass at his home in Maui.
So when you meet Ram Dass, or if you have the opportunity to meet Ram Dass and meet people in his satsang, a lot of what seems to us, or we would think about, as just being coincidence and, oh, it's the craziest thing, and this is how I met you, or this is how this came to be. What he would say is that that's all Maharaji bringing you to him, or bringing this experience to you. So Maharaji is Ram Dass's guru, Neem Karoli Baba. And so I guess now I would attribute this all to Maharaji. but in 1996 or 1997, I went through a really bad breakup, really horrible breakup. And I was in one of my bands at that time, and I was in a band with some really, really great people and close friends, and I was really struggling. And one of my bandmates gave me this cassette, and I remember it just having just, it just said Ram Dass on it, as far as I remember. And so I didn't know who Ram Dass was, but I put it in my car and I would listen to it. I was driving around. It was one 90 or 120 minute tape or something like that. And I really liked it. It was really helping. And in that some certain point, Ram Dass said something that I can't remember exactly, but it was something about forgiveness, I believe. And it was talking about in relation to recovery from childhood sexual abuse, or something related to sexual abuse. And I remember at that time just being so angry and pressing that eject button and throwing the cassette down on the floor and going, this guy has no idea what he's talking about. He's just, you know, full of shit, just talking his spiritual blah, blah, blah. And that was the beginning and end of my Ram Dass experience. And then several years later, when I started to get into yoga, and then I founded the Samaria Center and had more and more people around me with more diverse backgrounds and experience, someone brought up Ram Dass again. And we were just talking about Ram Dass, and someone mentioned that I should see this this documentary called Fierce Grace. And Fierce Grace is a beautiful documentary. It was very, very moving. And if you've ever seen it, or when you go and see it now, you'll know that in the first couple of, I think maybe like the first couple of minutes maybe of the documentary, there's a couple who lost their daughter to totally tragic circumstances, like I believe murdered in a park, little girl, I think 9 years old. And this couple is sitting there and they're reading this handwritten letter from Ram Dass.
Here is the mother reading the letter from Ram Dass.
Hare Hare Mahadeva. Hare Hare Mahadeva. Your rational minds can never understand what has happened. But your hearts, if you can keep them open to God, will find their own intuitive way. Rachel came through you to do her work on earth, which included her manner of death. Now her soul is free, and the love that you can share with her is invulnerable to the winds of changing time and space.
And I just remember watching that and just being profoundly affected to the point that I barely remember the rest of the documentary at that time, because all I could think about was, how would this person know what to say, and how would you reach out to someone that you'd never known before?
In that deep love, include me too. So much love, Ram Dass.
And so I just kind of tucked that away somewhere and then continued to have an interest in Ram Dass, but sort of from a distance. And then just last year, on December 26, 2014, I was on my way to my house in Mexico, and I stopped for a night in Puerto Vallarta. And on that morning, I witnessed a horrible accident in which a child was killed. And that was really, again, I guess I'd use the word profound and transformative, and shook up places in me that I didn't know that I had, both in terms of the depths of the darkness, but also in the depths of redemption, I guess, as well. And I just started to think in my head, again, I have to watch that documentary again, because there was something about that Ram Dass movie that's why I watched that movie all those years ago. So I got back home, I watched the documentary again, and I was again just completely moved. And so I signed up onto his Facebook page or something, and I started thinking to myself, I'm gonna write a letter to that family. And as I had that thought in my mind, and was kind of figuring out how I might go about that, all of a sudden one day in my feed it came up and said, many people have been wondering about the text of the letter that Ram Dass wrote to this family, and here's the text of the letter. And I was like, whoa, okay, this was kind of kismet. So I began, you know, my interest was even more drawn towards Ram Dass. So I began to then start listening to podcasts of his. That's when I started listening to podcasts, and I would listen to them all day, all night, all through the night, in the middle of the night, anytime I became sort of a podcast junkie for Ram Dass. And at one point my husband said, well, we should go and poke around his website and just see what else is out there for us in terms of Ram Dass. And we saw something about personal retreat, and I decided that was for me, and went through the vetting process that they have. And next thing I knew, I was on a plane to Maui. And the next thing I knew after that, I was swimming in Ram Dass's swimming pool. And that was like the most like surreal moment, when he wasn't there, no one was there, it was just my husband and I were on his grounds, and we're swimming in this pool, and I'm like, I am now swimming in Ram Dass's swimming pool on Maui. So that was all the lead up to being there. So I just got back, and I'm just so full of that experience. You know, when we're on Maui a couple of days ahead of time, and we kept being like, I wonder what Ram Dass's house is going to be like. Like, Oprah has a house there that's apparently, I'd imagine, just, you know, fabulous, and you can't find exactly. And there's everything from like really ultra rich people there to people born and raised on Maui. And so I was really, you know, I kept thinking, what's it going to be like? What's it going to be like? And so it's a little bit remote, only in the sense that you would have to know where it is to go there. Like, it's down like a long road. And then the grounds itself are, it's about 5 acres of land, and it's overlooking the ocean. So he has like a, you know, the proverbial sweeping view of the ocean, and a beautiful solar heated swimming pool with statues of Ganesha and Hanuman and Tara around. But then, and that was actually donated to him by one of his devotees, gave him that land. And so besides the land itself being beautiful and probably extremely valuable, his home and the home that we stayed in as retreatants is very modest. Looked maybe like, you know, somebody's nice summer home. Wasn't, you know, definitely not fancy, but very comfortable. And in his home and in the guest home, it's just everywhere pictures of Maharaji, Neem Karoli Baba, lots and lots and lots of Hanuman statues and tapestries and figures. There's also tons of books everywhere, so lots of spiritual reading, lots of altars set up all over the place. I feel like there's some, in his house, there's some pictures of Christ, and a beautiful, beautiful puja table, like a very extensive puja table. But just a really, really comfortable house, just a really nice place to be. Definitely felt like we were in sacred space. Yeah, you could feel that there was like a sort of a vibration happening there. I'm smiling. You can't see that there in podcast land, but I'm partially smiling because my husband and I have this thing where whenever, let's say we go to get a massage together and we're each in two different rooms, always Sasha gets the better thing, right? So I always come out of that, and he'll come out and go, that was the best massage I've ever had. Oh my gosh, blah, 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 whatever. And I'll be like, that was okay. And probably that says more about he and I and our personality styles than it does about the massage therapist. But anyway, so on our very first night there, when I couldn't sleep very well, And actually that was probably an interesting Maharaji thing too, because when I got there in the middle of the day, I said to Sasha, I said, this is a weird thing to say, but I feel so integrated right now, and I've been feeling so despairing lately, and I've been going through one of the two most difficult periods of my life. And suddenly I'm here and I'm feeling really integrated. And there's part of me that's like, I wish I was feeling so like despairing and disintegrated, because that's how I, you know, want to meet this person who will bring me to wholeness, or, you know, whatever thing I said. And so anyway, so that night I couldn't sleep very well. And I was having like really hectic dreams about who knows what, probably work related or something. And Sasha wakes up in the morning and he goes, wow, this place is just filled with spirits. Just all night long, I was having like these intense dreams and intense visions. And I was actually really mad at him for that. But the funny thing afterwards is that actually on that day, then that was the first day that I was going to meet Ram Dass. And so when I met Ram Dass, I was actually in like a really tender kind of less than like fully put together space. So that's just interesting, you know, be careful what you wish for. Yeah. So I'm a very devotional person in general. So I also have altars and a puja table and do a lot of ritual and devotional, different kinds of practices. And even if I'm going to a friend's house, like today, I can't believe I didn't have anything for you. Like I always have things. I'm always just like an offerer and a receiver. And so in my mind, I had all these ideas about how I was going to meet Ram Dass, and that we were going to be really focused and we were going to meditate ahead of time. And then I wasn't sure what I thought I was going to give him, because I was already at his house. But I, you know, knew exactly what time I had to get in the shower, so that I knew what I was going to wear and everything was going to be perfect. And so I'm in the shower and I suddenly hear Sasha go, oh, hey, hello, come on in. And I was like, you have got to be kidding me. And so I jump out of the shower and I'm completely discombobulated. I'm throwing my stuff all around and trying to put on like the outfit that I wanted to wear. And, so I came out into the other room and he was sort of just getting situated. And as soon as I saw him, I just burst out crying and fell to my knees and just cried for a while. And he was just kind of looking at me, and Sasha put his hand on me and then looked over at Ram Dass and said, she's just really happy. She's just been wanting this for a really long time. So That was the very first thing, and I was surprised. I wasn't that surprised, because I know myself. Like that's not totally outside of the realm of how I would react to something, but I didn't know that's how I was going to react right then. But being in Ram Dass's presence is an experience that is so beyond even my capacity to explain what that feels like and what that experience is like. And in fact, and I'll try my best, but when we got home, we're just, you know, we just are in this mode of we just want to read and be immersed in this experience and this satsang as much as we possibly can. And so one of the books that Sasha bought was by Krishna Das, called Chance of a Lifetime. And it's like on one of the very first pages, he opens it up and he says, Molly, listen to this. And Krishna Das is talking about the first time that he ever met Ram Dass. And he just explains it so well, just at least for me, and what Krishna Das is saying, I believe, is, you know, we live a spiritual life and we do spiritual practices and we have a sense that there is some kind of like godlike presence or a godlike state, or maybe not even godlike, what I would say is Christ-like, more like a Christ consciousness, something that seems like, if you would imagine what it might be like to be in the presence of Christ and Christ consciousness, what I would imagine is a feeling of holiness, a feeling of just absolute total unconditional acceptance, which is part of what Ram Dass talks about with Maharaji, that he realized that Maharaji could read his every thought. But as he was realizing that, he was also thinking, oh my gosh, I'm having all these bad thoughts. And then he had this next realization of like, but Maharaji seems to, like, he can read all these thoughts and he just loves me anyway. And that's very much the experience. It's this experience that I felt like I was in a place that was beyond anything I had known ever on a human level. And in my life as a yoga teacher and a spiritual seeker, I've met a lot of people that like vibrate at really high levels and lots of just incredibly wonderful and warm and dedicated and loving and bright people. I've met lots of those. For me, meeting Ram Dass was like any of those experiences, exponentially, really otherworldly. Really, it felt otherworldly. And at the same time, incredibly grounded. He's like so down to earth and so real. And so it was a very just unbelievably moving experience. Well, you know, I was pretty good at letting go of expectations. I didn't really know. It was really one of the experiences in my life, and especially in my spiritual life, that just felt, there was a few experiences that were similar in India where it felt like the wheels were just turning and it was like already happening and I just had to go with it. So I'm a person that does a lot and runs a lot and has my hands in a lot of pots. So usually I'm like in front of the curve, you know, and this was very much, I really didn't have a lot of expectations because I really, I just felt like I was being like pulled along. That being said, there were a couple of things. Before we left, we had prepared in a couple of different ways. One was that we had just watched something that was a fairly recent video, or maybe it was a webcast or something, of Ram Dass. And that was the first time Sasha and I were watching together. And Ram Dass, as many people, you know, if they know Ram Dass's story, will know that he suffered a pretty dramatic stroke, I guess about 15 years ago now, pretty severe stroke. In my life, before I had the Samaria Center, I was a speech pathologist, and working with stroke survivors was one of my specialties. And so I had continued to work with stroke survivors through my experience or through my time at the Samaria Center. So for me to be with someone who's a stroke survivor is actually, I'm very comfortable with that. But watching him and watching how sort of measured he was in his speech and how kind of slow he was, I noticed some anxiety coming up for me a little bit. I noticed myself thinking like, oh my gosh, like what if I get there and he's like somehow, I don't know what I thought, like incapacitated or something. But I think even more, I was starting to feel not protective, but worried about Sasha's reaction. Like, oh man, you know, we're going on this big pilgrimage, we're spending all this money, and we're going to go and we're going to see this guy, and you know, he can't really talk. And so some of that kind of stuff was coming up. But in that video, and I asked Sasha, what's your experience watching this? And in the middle of the video, Ram Dass's cat jumps up onto him, and Ram Dass is just petting his cat, Kush. And Sasha said, you know, when I see the way that cat loves him and the way he loves that cat, there's something that jumps out of this video for me that's like about this profound love that this man has. So I'm ready. So that was just sort of an interesting like moment of like, I guess, like fear, anxiety. And then the other thing was that through some of the like dark times that I've been going through and some of the changes that I've been going through in my inner life and then looking at my outer life, there's been some challenge with my relationship and just knowing like kind of we're very committed, but what does this mean? What does this mean for the rest of our life? And so I would joke around and be like, this is like a marriage encounter. So I was brought up Catholic. And so my parents went to marriage encounter. You know, I can still picture the old bumper stickers. And I'd always go, this is a marriage encounter, or any like argument we'd have, I go, we're taking it to Ram Dass. And so I kept kind of saying that it was going to be like this marriage thing. And then the other piece is that my assistant, Sarah, actually also helped me to frame it a little bit, because it's a completely personal self-directed retreat. And so she had some really good insight about Sasha and I just sitting down and really talking clearly more about what our expectations were of one another and how we saw this week unfolding, and that we wouldn't wait till we got there and then decide, you know, how we kind of wanted it to work. So we actually, we bought this journal and we made this cool art journal and put a bunch of stuff in it. And we put a little schedule for ourselves in it, which is really sweet. And after like one day, then we would joke around and we'd be like, all right, better check the retreat schedule. Okay. Yep. It's shared time or it's open time, because you basically have nothing to do all day. So I didn't have a whole lot of expectation really. And then that being said, whatever expectation I had, was just completely blown out of the water. I had no idea that I would come home feeling this way, feeling like more whole than I can remember feeling in a long time, more like secure. There's a quote by Swami Vivekananda where he talks about, I won't get it exactly right. I love Swami Vivekananda, but he says something about when you've got God behind you, like, what else do you have to worry about? Like, just focus on God. And then, you know, you've got God on your side, like nothing can intimidate you. And honestly, that's how I feel. And I'll be interested how long it lasts, but I very much have this feeling of any insecurity that comes through my mind, I think to myself, I've got Ram Dass on my side. What could scare me? Like, what could possibly make me feel insecure when I have Ram Dass on my side? And then by extension, Maharaji on my side. Yeah. Well, one of the things that I really became aware of in reflection is why Sasha and I had such a profound experience, is because of the openness that we came to that experience with, and the even like desire or orientation to feel something, or you use the word humbling, like the humility that we come with. I've been so humbled so many times in my work in general. I've been terribly humbled by being a teacher myself. I've been pedestalized, and then I've been jettisoned, you know, more times than most people could probably, or I don't say most people, than a lot of people could handle. You know, it's lovely being in my position, but it's also, it's not for like the sort of thin-skinned. And part of that, as you, I think, grow older and also grow deeper in your spiritual practice, is that you at once become a lot stronger and a lot more clear and a lot more self-assured, and at the exact same time, infinitely more humble. And so that recognition, that humility, like deep, deep humility, comes from a place of deep strength and a reservoir of like security, and then desirousness to know somebody who has that Christ-like feel. And so if one meets another being, and that person just isn't in that place, then they're not going to have the same experience. Talking about practice, we can practice giving it up to people in general. So someone says to me, I just discovered like the best coffee spot in all of Seattle, and it's, you know, whatever, let's say, for our community, we'll say it's Broadcast Coffee. And we might practice, for example, rather than saying, oh God, I've been going to Broadcast for years, or saying, oh, it was much better when it was Soho, or really, have you ever been to, you know, XYZ other coffee shop? Like, which is a lot of just It's just talk. Like, that's just how we talk. But we could, for example, in that situation, we could learn then to go, that is the best coffee, right? Or, oh, I haven't been there in so long. What's it like? Or, wow, what did you have, right? So we can learn just in our regular conversation to join people as much as possible and let go of the need to like one up or be right. I think we can also practice just practice being joyous and practice having a sense of humor. And then I think there are also lots of ways where we can practice. I mean, if we're talking about spiritual life and even like just beginning and kind of dipping our toes in it, one of the things we can practice is being in situations that we might normally say to ourselves, like, I don't really do that, right? I don't really chant, or I don't really go to a community meeting, or whatever it might be. And, or I don't really respond to people on Facebook, whatever it might be. And we can just practice, like, what would it be like for me to actually go, well, you know what, people are chanting here, so I'm just going to kind of change my orientation and say, well, what if I was a person that loved chanting? Or what if I was a person that didn't have any narrative at all? Or even if I was a person that the narrative that I'm used to is I don't like chanting. And then I remind myself, that's just a narrative. I don't have to stick with that narrative. So I think we could practice that, just being in more situations where we're just sort of open to what's happening. We could spend more time in any kind of devotional and spiritual spaces and really noticing what kind of baggage we bring or what kind of fetishizing we do. So like last year when I was in India, with my amazing group of students, wonderful group of students, and I'll totally include myself in this, when we were going to different temples, and that was new to us, at least to be in the temples, and having that experience was so new, and everybody was so devotional in the temples. All of my students would be very, very devotional in the temple, and they had no problem, like, just totally going for it, just, you know, prostrating themselves. I always feel like I'm going to say prostate. Does everybody else feel that way too? Prostrating themselves, you know, putting sacred ash on, like doing whatever the ritual was. And so we were all in the beginning, we were in Tamil Nadu, which is all Shaivite and Shiva temples. And so very, very like electrifying with that kind of Shiva energy. And then we went over to Kerala, which is more of a Christian state. So it has a lot of left of like Christian missionaries. You meet a lot of people who have Christian names rather than Indian names or Hindi names. And what I noticed then is when we would go into churches that my students would not show the same amount of reverence, right? And so then we'd be like, well, picture, or maybe even see something and we think it's funny, right? And so I myself am guilty of this. I'm actually working on a piece called a yoga journey back to Christ. Growing up Catholic, sorry, mom and dad. Like there was so much that we would just joke around with, kind of like we had no problem like giving each other a potato chip and being like the body of Christ. And my parents would be like, don't do that. And we'd be like, but it's funny, you know, or we would like make jokes about Jesus. And it's almost like it's so familiar to us. And it's also been sort of foisted upon us. And so I know it's not everybody, but I think a lot of people, then we grow up and we just like discard that and out of hand. We're just like, I don't want that, or I don't respect that, or it doesn't deserve the same amount of reverence. And so again, Swami Vivekananda is one of my favorite teachers, so I often quote him. He often talked about like when we're truly devotional and truly immersed in our own experience of God consciousness, then we see that everywhere. So we can look at Christ on the cross, or we could look at a Shiva Lingam, or we could look at one of these enormous Buddha statues right here in our neighborhood. And all of those things, because we know that for someone else, that is the symbol of God, and that it's imbued by a community of people and a community of seekers and community of contemplative and prayerful thinkers, that that is a symbol of God, and it has the same amount of reverence. We can offer it the same amount of reverence and devotion as we would to anything else. So I think that's a big mental shift that people can start to make if they want to open themselves up to these kinds of experiences. Just practice devotion, practice humility. As I said to him, you know, sometimes running the Samaria Center, it's so much work and it's so much stress. And I have, my job is like so disparate and I have so many different things to do and I really don't make any money. And so I often wonder, like, what does it mean to be following my Dharma? I could open up a private practice and a little tiny like office. And at this point in my career, I'm making air quotes in radio land, that I could have a very small operation and make more money with far less stress. And so I said that to him. And so how do I know? Like, am I just like this hamster? You know, what do I do? And so he said a couple of things that were really helpful. First, he said, the world needs you. The world needs this. And that was just like to hear Ram Dass saying that and talking about the Samaria Center and saying the world needs this. I was like, yes, it does, you know. And so we talked about that. And I said, and I'm uniquely, not exclusively, but I am uniquely qualified to have that kind of stewardship, and not everybody is. And I train lots of people as teachers and therapists, and their best way of serving the world will be in smaller groups. But I have the capacity to talk to and reach larger groups of people. And so therefore I have to do that. That's my work. So that felt good to hear that, because it's hard. The other thing he asked about was, how does the community support us financially? And so we had some conversations about that, and it sounds so crazy to say, we don't know when this is going to come out, but he also encouraged us to have a fundraiser and to ask our community and remind them that this matters. And if you believe in it, like, you have to help support it financially. Finances is part of the currency of life. He also told us to pray to Maharaji and that Maharaji would help us. And so we have been doing that. And then finally he said, not in these exact words, but something along the lines of, for me specifically, like, I just have a lot of roles and they're reinforced. So I have the role of the boss and the teacher and the executive director and the whatever. But then I also have roles that I cling to, or, you know, reinforce for myself. I also have the wife and I'm also the daughter and all of this. And so specifically, he talked a lot about role to soul, move from role to soul. And so specifically with the center and me, he said, when you have to administrate, just administrate. When you have to teach, just teach. It's just your role and you can do it well, so do it well. But always remember that it's just a role. It's like you're watching a movie and it's your movie, and you can like be as good of an actor as everybody wants you to be, and like you're accountable, and so you'll do that. But then you know that you walk off the set or you walk off the stage and you're like, that actually has nothing to do with me. And so that also felt very, very relieving. So I came home feeling like more like I can totally do, like, more energized, and then at the same time more letting go. So that was really helpful. Yeah. We often talked about saying, this isn't a therapy session. And then I'd say, Babaji, this sounds like a therapy session. And I'll tell you what, it was the best therapy ever. Yeah. I asked Babaji if I could do an ongoing satsang in his name, and I had been waiting for him to respond, and he actually just responded and gave his blessing for me to do an ongoing Ram Dass satsang. So I'll be doing ongoing Ram Dass satsang at the Samaria Center, and also, so anyone who's out there listening, I know that the podcast has listeners all over the world. We'll also, if that's your interest, you can email us, and you can let us know. If there's some, we'll try to figure out some way that we can keep our podcast. We could stream it. Jocelyn says we could stream it. She's very smart and capable.
Molly will be leading a Ram Dass satsang once a month. You can join us on the internet. We'll be streaming that. Find us on the web at thesamariacenter.org. You can also find us on Facebook. The Samaria Center is a community-based organization dedicated to individual transformation and radical social change. If you'd like to support our mission, find us at samariacenter.org.